Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
Hey, TERFs and trannies. You're listening to Heterodorks. I am Nina Paley, your co-host.
And I am Corinna Cohn, your other co-host. And we have a special guest heterodork with us today. It is Dr. J. Michael Bailey, the author of everybody's favorite children's bedtime book, The Man Who Would Be Queen. I read this to the children in my family every night. Don't you, Nina?
I recommend it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I find random street urchins to read it to, since I don't have children of my own.
Good. They could use some extra education.
Yes, but not in Florida.
Right.
Once in fourth grade, you can start then.
Yes. So, first, J. Michael Bailey. My first question is, what is the J for?
It's for John. My parents named me John Michael Bailey, and they called me Michael and Mike growing up. So, because my uncle was John, I don't know, one John in the family, I guess. So anyway, I've never gone by John, and if somebody ever calls me John, it's annoying to me, and I know that they have no idea who I am. So
okay, all right.
So no dead naming you.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So I wanted to, before I ask you a bunch of questions, I wanted to share my story of reading The Man Who Would Be Queen for the first time. So I was TERFed in, I guess shortly before I was TERFed, when I was starting to be called a TERF and not really knowing why, because I was not remotely transphobic and had trans friends and had hung out with trans people and had trans lovers and all that stuff. People kept saying, educate yourself. And since I was already quite educated about transsexuals and knew several and had been in the sex positive San Francisco scene in the 90s, I thought, well, I guess I have to educate myself about this TERFy stuff. And in addition to learning about radical feminists and reading Andrea Dworkin for the first time, I came across The Man Who Would Be Queen. And I approached it with much skepticism. And, you know, reading along, I was like, yeah, right. And then as I read, I got this slow sinking feeling of like, this is right. Like, this totally jibes with all of my experience, including and in particular, lovers of mine who were, I realized, autogynephilic. And I really didn't want to acknowledge that, but yeah, the more I read, and I was like, whoa, and that was part of my world turning upside down. So I just wanted to share that with you, and that yes, I had a serious relationship with an autogynephile and another less serious relationship with an autogynephile a few years later. And of course, I did not know what autogynephilia was and only learned that word for it later.
Well, I really like the story. Nothing makes me happier than somebody telling me they think I'm right about something.
I came across your book a little different way.
Yeah.
I have been around the trans circles for a while, and I had not heard of you before about, 2004, 2005?
Right.
And when I did hear about you, it was from people who were extremely alarmed about the content of the book. Mm-hmm. And I just did not find the reactions proportionate with the content. And I had, I'm sorry to say this, but I pirated a copy of your book because it was floating around as a PDF for a while.
Everybody should pirate it. It actually is downloadable for free on the publisher's website now because it's out of print. And I would love for people to share it, especially with their grandparents and their children.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, to make up for it, I did acquire a book. I stole it from
cool.
a bookstore.
All right.
So it's all square now. I was really surprised by the trans community's reaction to it, though, because one of the things that I've always thought is that even if you really disagree with somebody's idea, that there's not really a good reason to go after that person with personal attack. And that if you see somebody going after somebody with personal attacks, that is really a signal of the quality of the person who's making the complaint. And it's not a very high signal of quality.
We need more people like you in the world right now, and we're getting fewer by the day.
I hope that's only something that's of a slight apparent change, and that it's not actually a real change, because I think most people are pretty reasonable and thoughtful.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm in a university, you know, and academia is broken right now. It's in many ways. I've been an academic. I've been in the university as a graduate student forever and so on. But I started working in 1989, and there were golden years of inquiry and intellectual debate among people who, you know, strongly disagree, but you could do it. I would say until, I don't know, the early 2010s, maybe 2012 or so on, is when things started to get bad, and the past couple of years have been especially bad. And I never fear talking about my work and writings about transgender and sexual orientation or any sexuality, really. However, I know some people have really gotten canceled for that. And there are other topics that I stray far away from, especially race. But the topic that I have studied and written about that is most frightening these days for me to write about, and I've hesitated to write something that I feel like I should, is pedophilia. I don't know if you followed the Alan Walker case a few months ago. Alan Walker was a researcher studying, and Alan Walker is non-binary, and I have trouble with pronouns. They studied what they call MAPS, minor attracted persons, but I would call pedophiles. And they were not promoting pedophilia at all. They were sympathetic with minor attracted persons who are trying to live lives without having sex with children, and they were trying to help them. And they had an interview that went viral on Twitter and so on. And I watched it. It was entirely reasonable, nothing at all wrong with it. And eventually they had to resign their tenure track position at Old Dominion. I just thought it was terrible. I have been wanting to write something maybe for Quillette with the title "Let's Normalize Rational Discussion About Pedophilia." But so I live with my partner, and she, you know, she has asked me, please, if you ever do an interview regarding this research, please don't let them take your picture. You know, we live in a condo building, there are children, and so on. And you know, it's just people can really. They can mess your lives up about this stuff. I do not want to promote sex between adults and children, but I do want to promote rational discussion about the phenomenon. So that's more scary to me than autogynephilia, not scary at all to talk about.
Yeah, well, Corinna and I have had some conversations about pedophilia. We have yet to discuss it on Heterodorks. My interest really is in taboos and the social function of taboos. And Yeah, well, but I've always railed against taboos. I've always been like, well, we should be able to talk about anything. And in the last few years, I've thought maybe taboos like fill a purpose. Even though I've railed against them, maybe there is a positive purpose that they fill that I have not given them enough credit for. But that's another discussion for another time. I have questions about autogynephilia.
All right. Yes. I'm rearing to go.
All right. First of all, Are you still doing research in this area?
absolutely doing a lot with my longtime collaborator, Kevin Sue. His last name is spelled H-S-U. He was my PhD student. He's now an assistant professor at Penn State Abington. And he is leading a very important study, and I will be part of their research team. But he has launched a very large survey of, he's not recruiting people on the basis of autogynephilia per se. It's people who are, you know, either gender dysphoric or think about being, changing their sex, natal males again. So, and we've looked at the first round of data. We got over, I think, 1,500 responses so far, and very, very high levels of autogynephilia in the sample. And the intention is to follow people up over time and see, you know, what, if anything, predicts happy outcomes. And it's a tragedy and an outrage that we don't know more about the long-time trajectories of autogynephilia and autogynephilic persons, especially given that it is, in the West, the leading cause of male, natal male transgenderism.
I have another question. How common is autogynephilia? And I mean that just in the general population. And also, I assume autogynephilia is sort of a spectrum from rare fantasizing or experimental cross-dressing to full-on transitioning. So another way to ask this question is, how many men have no autogynephilia whatsoever?
Yeah, so the easy answer is we don't know. And I've seen estimates. So Anne Lawrence is a brilliant scholar of autogynephilia, although I think she considers herself retired from such scholarship now. But she, based on a survey that I don't think is very persuasive, I think she thinks maybe 5% or something like that. I personally think that's likely way too high.
I got to say, I don't think that's too high. My experiences with men, no, I don't think that's too high.
We worry about selection effects,
yes. You know, and that's legit.
You know, you'd want to do a representative survey, which, you know, you could never do, and have people answer honestly, which I'm less persuaded than some people are about the spectrum part of it, at least the mild, the very low key part of the spectrum. It's not that I know that it's false. I just haven't seen good evidence for, yeah, somebody who says, yeah, you know, occasionally, you know, I think of being a woman and it's arousing, but I don't think about it much, but I just haven't talked to people like that. And when I've, in our research, when we have surveyed samples of autogynephilic natal males, on the scale, it's called the core autogynephilia scale, which can go from 0 if you're not at all to 8, they're bunched up around 6, 7, and 8. They're showing a lot of autogynephilia. We don't get many who were, say, on a particular website, likely about people who like to think about switching genders and so on.
But your sample is among people with gender dysphoria. Yes, so yes, I would think that you would have extreme cases.
No, the current one is, we have in the past recruited people. We've collected several samples of autogynephilic persons. And one of them, for example, was natal males who are sexually aroused by cross-dressing, which is not necessarily gender dysphoria. Right. And we have another one that is natal males who are sexually aroused by cross-dressing or fantasizing about being women and so on, which is not necessarily gender dysphoria. anyway.
I mean, I'm just talking about the population of men.
I'm just saying, my point was simply that when autogynephilia is there, it seems to be really there and not just kind of there. And you're absolutely right. We need to know the rate. I mean, to answer your question, and I think it would be very interesting to answer your question if we could, we would need to know out of all men, how many are autogynephilic. And here's my reasoning, and you can tell me what's wrong with it. Start with gay men, who I would, my best estimate in the U.S., maybe 3% of men. And they are very visible. They're big sections of cities. You see them, if not everywhere, lots of places. They're very, and one sees autogynephilia. I would say, you know, heterosexual crossdressers are, they're autogynephilic. One sees them, but boy, not nearly as often as 3%.
Yeah, I know one person in this conversation who hasn't been to very many tech conferences.
Oh, boy, we gotta talk. We gotta talk about maybe collaborating on a study. That's something that Kevin and I have been trying to study, because as you know, there is a stereotype about autogynephilic males being very technical, you know, computer science might be the prototypic pursuit. And I don't know if that stereotype is true. I sure know instances. You have more experience. Do you think it's true?
I have my theories, but being that I'm not a scholar, I'm hesitant to forward them as having
we all start with intuitions.
I have some intuition.
We can't start with, you know, settled data. Yeah.
Well, let me explore one of mine with you, because I'm interested in your feedback. I've been paying attention to some of the stories of male detransitioners and of the cohort of, I know that you're aware of the ROGD girls, but of the boys who have similar demographic characteristics of starting to identify as transgender at about the onset of puberty. And as I'm looking at these stories, and I'm seeing myself in these stories quite a lot, actually, of boys who are very often quite bright, have some social development delays, are targets by bullies, and who are not very accepted by their male peer groups. And sometimes it's because they're effeminate, and sometimes because they just don't develop the same sort of the correct set of social skills they need in order to get along with their male peers. And that this group is highly represented in the number of young males who are exploring transition. And to me, there seems to be so many traits there that go back before the onset of puberty of just, and to me, it's centrally a delay in social development. And although a portion of this group does display some traits that you would see as autogynephilic in an adult doing it, this is also a group that is still undergoing a lot of identity formation. So my question or hypothesis is that the trans identification or cross-sex identification goes way beyond sexual target error, and that it has as much to do with problems with social development in youth.
It sounds to me like you're saying that ROGD isn't just something that happens for natal females, but also for natal males for some of the same reasons. Is that?
That's what I think, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that is a fine hypothesis, and I think that we just don't know whether that's true. You know, I think I've made some people on gender podcasts uncomfortable a little I know I won't make you uncomfortable by saying that I think that it's hard to rule out autogynephilia in those cases because these adolescent boys are not telling their parents about their sexual fantasies and habits and so on. I don't think the fact that some of these traits emerge before sexuality means that it can't be autogynephilia either. I think that, you know, autogynephilia, there are correlates of sexual orientation, some sexual orientations, like, you know, homosexuality, heterosexuality. They have the gender nonconformity correlate, and wouldn't surprise me if autogynephilia has maybe some different early emerging correlates. And you may know about these. There's some case reports, a couple of extremely young children who are showing florid autogynephilia. I mean, like wanting to, a little boy wanting to wear his mother's panties when he's, I don't know, he's like four. And that, I may have that age wrong, but it's very young. That case report, which was written by Ken Zucker, you know, who I assume you know, when Zucker had a private conversation with the boy's father, the father admitted that he, unbeknownst to anybody else in the family, was a crossdresser, which I think is quite amazing. But I do think there are data suggesting that autogynephilia runs in families, I would guess, for genetic reasons. But again, we don't know.
When I hear that story, I think that if a father is cross-dressing, even if he thinks nobody is aware of it, if there's a kid in the house, the kids, a lot of times adults don't really pay attention to the presence of their kid, and that the kid could probably know that without the father knowing that the kid knows that.
Well, my intuitions differ from yours, but I guess, you know, that's the problem with these kinds of cases. We can never know.
Yeah. Hey, I want to ask more maybe straightforward questions.
How common
is the coincidence of autogynephilia with personality disorders like narcissistic personality disorder, and how do researchers measure this?
Nobody has, to my knowledge, and I think I would know, nobody has tried to answer that question. I think it's very important to distinguish the possibility of an association between autogynephilia and personality traits or disorders from the co-occurrence of autogynephilia and narcissism among particular subsets of people, such as certain trans activists. Those are, you know, that's not a random sample of autogynephilic persons. And you might expect that, let's say, people who self-select for being entitled and complaining and so on, that they might have issues. And that might be true no matter what their sexuality was. Here's what I do think. The idea of autogynephilia is a narcissistic injury for some autogynephilic persons, perhaps many. That's not how they want to see themselves. That's not how they have seen themselves. But I think that that's different than saying that they're narcissistic. You could hurt my feelings and you could change the way I thought about myself, and that would be a narcissistic injury. But I don't think I'm a narcissist, although, you know, I'm sure that you can read otherwise on the internet somewhere.
I guess since I have known and do know some autogynephiles, It seems like some manage it pretty sanely, and others are completely unhinged, with the unhinged ones elevating the reputation of autogynephilia as something that is completely unhinged, whereas the ones that are managing it less so. But it does, how can I say it? Like, no, not all autogynephiles respond in a completely insane way, with not all of them experience narcissistic injury when hearing about autogynephilia. So I think that the really unhinged ones have something else going on.
I agree with you. And there's also, there's another aspect of narcissism that sometimes occurs, and that is a couple of cases of well-known trans women. I have to be careful how I say this. First, Deirdre McCloskey, I don't know if you know who she is. She's quite a famous economist, and she was also one of my attackers. She wrote an autobiography that came out before my book called Crossing, and I had not said something about it in my book without having read it, and I regret that. That was unscholarly, and when she attacked me, she said as much. But in that book, you read it, she's very open about cross-dressing, erotic cross-dressing. She used to, as a kid, she would break into people's houses to steal women's lingerie and so on. And not at all as Donald. He was a football player at Harvard and very masculine in intellectual style. And when I say about, I need to be careful, Deirdre McCloskey threatened to sue me if I ever publicly called her autogynephilic. So I'm not. I'm just saying that she has all the behaviors.
But she's definitely a homosexual, transsexual.
Though. That's right. That's right.
Right.
But, and then another one is the ex-husband of Christine Benvenuto, mm-hmm. who wrote a beautiful book. I forget what the name of it is, about the breakup of her marriage. Her ex-husband, before he became a woman, was a rabbi. And when they broke up, all the friends abandoned her and supported him. Anyway, I think both McCloskey and Benvenuto's ex-husband behave very narcissistically toward their spouses. Were very, I don't know, kind of unsympathetic to what they put their spouses through. It's not to say that, you know, they shouldn't have gone ahead and transitioned, but there's very little evidence in McCloskey's book that she felt for them. And certainly that there's little evidence in Benvenuto's book that her ex-husband did so. And so that strikes me as kind of narcissistic. What I want matters, what you want doesn't, because I'm important. But again, I think that's selected. I don't think there's any reason to think that all autogynephilic persons behave that way in relationships. Although you have more, Nina, you have more experience than I do. I don't know if that came up in your relationships.
I mean, I thought that I had seen statistics about comorbidity with autogynephilia of personality disorders. But I will look that up after.
Okay. And if you find anything, please let me know. Yeah. But that is something that needs to be studied. And I forget whether Kevin's survey has anything about diagnoses. It's easy enough just to ask people whether they've ever received a formal diagnosis, and if so, what it was.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it would be hard to get good numbers on that. But I do think that autogynephilia, like when I say that, how can I say it? Autogynephilia itself does not need to be stigmatized as much as it is. Autogynephilia in combination with personality disorder and institutional enabling is what people, I think, take the most issue with. And if these things can be separated out, so that if somebody realizes that, if a man realizes he's autogynephilic, that does not mean he necessarily has to behave in a horrendous way towards other people.
Yeah, autogynephilia is stigmatized by both sides, kind of the trans women and kind of the left. They stigmatize the idea of autogynephilia. And if anybody identifies as autogynephilic or says, yeah, I believe it, they are likely to be shunned and attacked and so on, thus putting a lot of people in the closet. And then the gender critical side. So they have some legitimate complaints about some likely autogynephilic persons, but I find some of them to be very unkind toward autogynephilic persons. Look, I get a lot of correspondence back channel by autogynephilic persons thanking me for writing my book. It helped them understand themselves for the first time and so on. And so many of these people, I think, are admirable. You know, I think autogynephilia is a tremendous challenge. It's a very difficult sexuality to understand. It's certainly not, it's one that is, even in a fairly liberal environment, it's one that's, people are not going to get it. They're not going to probably want to get involved, be very sympathetic.
I'm sorry, so did you say it's a sexuality? Is that different from a paraphilia?
Well, paraphilias are sexualities. And I do think that autogynephilia is a paraphilia. And one of the lines of research that I'm most excited about, which I have published none of, but getting it in the pipeline, is addresses the question of whether there is some sort of essence to paraphilia that is shared across different paraphilias. Do they have anything in common? Or is paraphilia just a word for weird sex stuff that we don't like? And I have found evidence for something that many, but perhaps not all, paraphilias have in common. And it's not anything in the brain. It's more like a pattern of questionnaire responses. But autogynephilia has stuff in common with some other paraphilias that are kind of, they're like internalized targets. So being a furry has some stuff in common with autogynephilia. There are some people who want to become amputees. That seems to have something in common.
Yeah, well, I'd give my left arm to be part of that group.
Good one.
Probably some kinds of so-called age play. Also, yeah, I know. Ugh. Sorry. As long as it's adults pretending, that's okay.
Yeah. No. So Kevin and I published the first paper on something called autopedophilia, which is the sexual arousal at the idea of being a child, and we found that was not uncommon in a sample of pedophiles. And so Ray Blanchard has wrote a classic paper on the target location errors. And to paraphrase a key part of the paper, he said, for every form of attraction, there are basically any kind of paraphilic object. Some men have an attraction for it, but a subset of men want to be it. And these tend to be related. You don't want to be it unless you're attracted to it. You know, autogynephilia is like that, to the extent that autogynephilic persons are attracted to other people, it tends to be women.
Makes sense.
Can on the subject of being attracted to things, can we talk about gynandromorphiles for a moment?
Sure.
So the question I wanted to ask you is, can women, or are there women who are gynandromorphiles?
So gynandromorphophilia is, so I'm just going to say words and you can bleep them out if you want, is attraction to she-males. She-male, it's a term that I don't really see as offensive, but I know some people do, but many people know what it is. It's a natal male, typically with surgical breasts and a penis still. So it's a transitioning trans woman, partially transitioned trans woman. So it's attraction to that. And I think to classify somebody, I'm going to say GAMP for gynandromorphophilia as a GAMP, they probably need to have a very strong level of attraction, perhaps even preferring. I mean, in their sexual fantasies, that needs to be there a lot, perhaps even most of the time. Because it turns out that a lot of just straight men are capable of being sexually aroused by she-males. So regarding your question about can natal females be GAMPS? Well, I had a conversation at a sex research conference with a woman who's she's very open sexually, and she with her, I guess she's had some sex parties, threesomes with a she-male. She found it extremely sexually arousing. Now, is she a GAMP? I would doubt it. I mean, it's an open question whether women have paraphilias in the same way that men do. Now, in all the surveys we do, when we allow female responses, and these days we try also to, we get a subset of women saying, yes, I also am sexually attracted to animals or to amputees or whatever it is. The question is, do they have paraphilias? And, you know, as a scientist, I think that it needs more evidence just they say that they're attracted to similar things that the males do. And I have found some evidence that, I mean, men and women do sexual orientation differently. This another strand of our research. For example, if we bring people into the lab and we have them watch very sexually explicit videos featuring either male actors or female actors, but not both, and we measure their genital response, and also if we just ask them, how turned on were you? Men are very regular. Their penises and their voices go with their sexual orientation. Straight men get erections to female stimuli, but not to male. Gay men show the opposite patterns. But most women, and most women are straight women, are indifferent in the lab. They show equal genital arousal to both male and female stimuli, and they pretty much say, yeah, it's similarly arousing. Now, I don't think that that means that all women are, or most women are bisexual, though it may mean that women have, likely means they have an increased capacity for bisexuality. I think we don't understand female sexual orientation nearly as well as we understand male sexual orientation. And, you know, I pretty much focus on males these days just because they're in some ways easier to study.
Yeah, we're more interesting, Nina.
You're easier to study.
Yeah.
I have another question. Speaking of bisexuality, a friend of mine who is autogynephilic and aware of it and young shared a post with me from the Reddit, the bisexual subreddit, where somebody asked, any guys here watch straight porn and put themselves in the girl's position? And my friend said, lots of men replied, yes, this is how I realized I was bi. My friend's question is, how many cases of male bisexuality are in fact autogynephilia linked?
I think that's a fantastic question. And definitely there is a correlation between autogynephilia and bisexual identity. Definitely, we find that. And I do want to make the point that autogynephilic bisexuality has been called by Ray Blanchard pseudo-bisexuality. Here's why. Some autogynephilic persons, natal males, they get turned on by the fantasy of having sex with a man, sometimes by the act of having sex with a man. But they're not focusing on that man's physical appearance. They're not saying, oh, he's hot. Look at his body. Oh, that penis is just hot. It's the implications of the act for the role. They're being turned on by being a woman with a man, or in a woman's role sexually with a man. And we've actually shown this in our lab studies. We've had autogynephilic persons and also GAMPs in the lab. And one thing they have in common, both cross-dressers who are all autogynephilic and GAMPs have in common, is that they got bigger erections to she-male stimuli than to female stimuli. but they still both also got far larger erections to erotic stimuli depicting women than to erotic stimuli depicting men. And they were no different in the latter from just plain old straight men. They do not get erections to men, per se.
Or it seems like they're responding a lot to these cues, to what we might call gender cues. I went through a time when I lived in San Francisco in the 90s. One of the reasons that I am aware, or one of the things that formed my ideas about male sexuality, was my sex positive days in San Francisco, where part of that time I was a professional dominatrix. And so I was seeing all kinds of things, including that age play stuff that we talked about.
Mm.
Well, one thing I wanted to say is that when somebody has sex and they're thinking about themselves the whole time, that certainly falls into a kind of narcissism. I mean, when your sexuality itself is all about you rather than your partner, or if your partner is like a kind of prop to enhance your sexuality. And by the way, this is not remotely exclusive to autogynephiles. This is very widespread in male sexuality in general. And many heterosexual women have the experience, particularly of, maybe exclusively of, men who use porn. Porn use is so widespread that finding a man that doesn't use porn is exceedingly statistically difficult. But yes, the experience for women can very much be just like used. You realize that the man is using you to masturbate, basically.
Yeah, certainly. Yes, male sexuality can be quite shallow that way and selfish. I want to respond to two things, but I want to have you remember to say something about dominatrix. But first, I want to take on the idea that autogynephilia, because it's inner-directed, that is a form of narcissism. And I don't think that's correct. For one, it's not that autogynephiles are saying, oh, I'm such a great person, let me just fantasize about what a great person I am. They're fantasizing about the idea of being women before they're women. They're not, you know, they're not women. And often they actually have a lot of disgust and dysphoria about their male aspects, which I don't think is narcissistic. So, you know, I think these internalized sexualities, which again, it's not just autogynephilia, it's some furries, some people who want to be amputees, and so on. Adult babies like to pretend that they're babies. By the way, they're not attracted to babies. We've studied this. So there's nothing pedophilic or anything about them. But anyway, there are these strange inward directed sexualities, but I don't think it's about narcissism.
I think we're using different definitions of narcissism. I do not think of narcissism as, oh, I'm so great. That is not at all. It's more of a self preoccupation that precludes a lot of meaningful relationships, meaningful intimate relationships, because in the intimate relationship, the narcissist is so preoccupied with themselves, and it can be very unpleasant for the narcissist. They can feel like a victim all the time. They can feel persecuted and paranoid and, you know, incredibly needy and terrified, because what they need the other person to be doing is validating them and approving of them and reinforcing their idea about themselves. And they're just unable to set that aside and actually just see or be with another person or be interested in another person. And I thought of that when you were saying, you know, the sexual response of a autogynephilic bisexual, if he's with a man, is not like, oh, this guy I'm with is so hot. Normally, you would think, like in a sexual experience, each person is, you know, witnessing the other person, and it's a ideally airy fair. I'm a woman here, so bear with me. It's like this transcendent thing where you commune with another being, you know, where you put your own self aside and you enter into some altered state where you're fascinated with the other person. And I think in the case of narcissists, most of the time they're trapped with themselves and in a state of anxiety and a real need for the other person. I need to control the other person because their vulnerability, like they need that other person to validate them. And again, I am not talking about autogynephilia here. I am talking about narcissism here, which may or may not coincide.
Yeah. Well, I think women tend to be a lot better than men at having relationships.
Oh, we're not. And,
well, you have your different weaknesses within those, I guess. But yeah, right.
I got to ask this because I checked your Twitter. I don't see that anybody's ever asked you this before, Dr. Bailey. And yeah. I think the internet someday is going to want to know your opinion. Are traps gay?
Traps?
Traps. Yeah.
I don't remember what traps mean, if I ever knew, so you'll have to explain it.
Traps would be, there's a culture of young men who are late teens, early 20s, who dress up as women and as convincingly as they can, and then try to turn on other males for the express purpose of sexually exciting other males, and they're called traps.
Yeah. Okay. I actually have.
So are traps gay?
I'll start as usual by saying okay. I don't know, but I do have maybe something interesting to say. I received an email correspondence from somebody like this who had read my book, and you know, my initial thought was, well, this seems most likely what we would call interpersonal autogynephilia. That's the when autogynephiles like male attention, you know, and are aroused by it. But no, he persuaded me that he truly was gay, and he liked doing this. And the men who picked him up, I think he was in Toronto, on Queen Street or whatever. They knew that he was a guy. And many of them were probably autogynephilic, GAMP, because autogynephilia and gynandromorphophilia are pretty strongly co-occurring. So, gosh, the one case that I know anything about, I would say, was, and maybe so. And, you know, there are certainly, I guess it's different, but a lot of sex workers on the street. There are areas where there are trans women on the street. And I think they're all homosexual, transsexuals. They're male attracted. They're androphilic. But, Nina, before we get too far from this, I do want to say something about dominatrixes and ask you. So what I'll say is that Ray Blanchard actually did a study of dominatrixes' customers and found that they had a fairly strikingly high rate of cross-dressers. And this is something we haven't talked about yet. There seems to be an association, a pretty strong association between autogynephilia and masochism. And so, Nina, did you ever have such people come see you?
Probably, but remember, this was a brief phase in my life, and this was... Oh. Really, I was in the scene, the sex positive scene in San Francisco. So way beyond just that bit of dominatrixing, I was going to the parties, and there was something called San Francisco Sex Information Hotline, which I was trained for. And there was this whole community, and there was the Janus Society of Kinky People. So I was in that milieu, and yes, cross-dressing was big part of it. And I thought it was fun and transgressive and cool. And I was a lot younger. And yeah, I saw plenty of that. and plenty of all kinds of, you know, putting on vinyl yeah. suits with little holes in them and all sorts of things. Back yeah. in the day.
Yeah, we're about to launch a big survey of BDSM. Nobody's ever studied it the way we want to study it.
Oh, interesting.
but the strongest, the most striking evidence for the association between autogynephilia and masochism comes from studies of the death scenes of practitioners of autoerotic asphyxia. Autoerotic asphyxia is when somebody arranges to strangle themselves, typically during masturbation. It's a turn on. I think it's often been thought of as it's about reducing the blood flow, and there might be something to that, but it's mainly a masochistic activity. The death scenes of these individuals have all kinds of masochistic pornography next to them. There have been a couple of studies of these unfortunate people. By the way, that death scenes, because sometimes things go wrong. They don't mean to kill themselves, but they might have a seizure. They might lose consciousness and not be able to get back on the chair. About a quarter of the time when these men's bodies are found, they're overwhelmingly male, about a quarter of the time they're cross-dressed. And there's no obvious reason for that other than the co-occurrence between masochism and autogynephilia.
We're not supposed to say, but it's apparent that they died doing something that they love.
Yeah.
I have to say that, like, the real stuff, like real bona fide masochism and sadism, that is so beyond my depth. In San Francisco in the 90s, in this scene, it was popular culture and it was bleeding over into the mainstream. But like the actual, I was so out of my depth dabbling in that.
So this is something I'm very interested in, and we're trying to get at it in the survey. And that's the issue of is there much overlap between BDSM parties, kind of sexy rubber leather stuff and playing, and like more hardcore sadism and masochism? And, you know, I guess for sadism, we have these sexually sadistic serial killers who do horrible things and so on. And masochism, I think autoerotic asphyxia is an extreme because, you know, that these people are doing it by themselves, you know. It's not something they're doing because the cool kids are doing it, you know. So do you have a sense, Nina, whether you came across any serious sadism or masochism? And I'm sorry, I can't even define what I mean by serious.
Yeah,
sadism.
I mean, I did. And I, you know, looking back on it, it's like, yeah, I got myself in some situations that were out of my depth. It could have been much worse. But I did not know what I was dealing with because, again, there was this sort of blurring into like friendly mainstream culture, and there was this mixing of anybody that was interested in any kind of sex or talking about sex would end up in the same communities. So, you know, maybe you were brought there because you were interested in sex education or safer sex. It was the AIDS era, the height of the AIDS era, and we were all trying to do outreach about condoms and dental dams and things. Maybe you were there because you were, you know, like genuinely hardcore sadistic or masochistic. Certainly there was cross-dressing. There was an element of it that was light and fun. I mean, I think a lot of people that were there were really basically okay, and as they had some kink and they found a community that they could find consensual people to play with, as they said, consensually. And there were also a lot of creepers, and a lot of creepers that knew not to appear too creepy in these milieus because they had some standards about being super creepy. But yeah, there's going to be an overlap. I'm certain it's changed a lot because this was a more innocent time. God only knows what is happening now. But I do want to get to another question, another burning question. So both Anne Lawrence and my autogynephilic ex support castrating young male autogynephiles. And I assume they are fixated on what might have been had they not been masculinized by puberty, and figure even if it's too late for them, there may be boys like them who need not suffer their masculine fate. And I just mentioned this because by the normal standards of the world, that's really out there, right? Like, but this, the last time I talked to my autogynephilic ex was like 5 years ago. And I consider him a pretty sane and decent man. But that was something he was really adamant about the last time I talked to him, is that, yes, they children should definitely be able to trans. And of course, you've probably heard Anne Lawrence's recent interview. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I would like to talk about that. I am opposed to castrating children, but I'm not opposed to castration in general, you know, like once somebody's an adult. But like, what the heck? Like that has to be one hell of a desire to bring you to the point where that, I mean, that is like so outside of the mainstream. And that must be just like, what is going on with that? I'm trying to say this in a way that like, I don't personally judge that, but I am aware that that is like way outside stuff that normal people want to talk about. I do want to talk about it. So Anne Lawrence, if you're listening to this, please, I want to talk to you.
Yeah. Yes, I know about Anne's. I heard her on the podcast, plus we've talked about it together. And I think I closer to you than I am to Anne on this. So here's one thing that I'm not sure about is how widespread, you know, unhappiness among autogynephiles is, even who transition autogynephiles, how unhappy they are with the result. And, you know, they've all transitioned well after puberty. They went through masculinizing puberty. And so I know some say, well, think about how great it would have been. But I don't know that a lot of them are just so unhappy with what they got. If you know differently, jump in.
So I started HRT at 18 and had sex reassignment surgery at 19. And I've had so many older transitioning trans women express, oh, how jealous they are and how they'd give anything to be able to do that. And the one thing that really strikes me, there's a couple of things. One is that when people who have built their lives and have a family and have a career and children, that they would sacrifice all of those things to switch places with me, and they have absolutely no idea what they'd be giving up to do that. So that's one thing. The other thing is, and maybe I'm interested in your insight on this, I don't know why you would fantasize, as long as you're fantasizing, I don't know why you'd fantasize about transitioning at a young age, because if you're going to fantasize, why not fantasize the whole way and fantasize that you're actually the opposite sex? Because if you're entertaining a fantasy, it's so weird to fantasize that you would change your sex earlier.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So here's what I think regarding transition among autogynephilic persons. First, we need some data better than Anne Lawrence's wisdom, and she is very wise. But I think Kevin Sue, who's collaborating with James Morandini, who's a great clinical psychologist in Australia, on this long-term study. And it would be good if we could identify predictors of severe gender dysphoria that results in transition. And if we can, then, you know, if they're going to transition anyway, pretty much, then why not let them do it early? But we don't have any data that supports that.
Oh, could I interrupt you?
Yeah. Yo, go ahead.
I have very good reason why you shouldn't do it early. And that is, I'm sorry, this is very personal, but at the age that I transitioned, I had not really had any sexual exploration. I had a lot of discomfort about my body. Being intimate was very difficult. And one thing that I believe now, that if I had had somebody who is a little bit older than me when I was a teenager, if I had somebody who had been able to help calmly work through my sexual issues and help explore myself, that I would have been able to find comfort with my sexed body without feeling like I needed to transition, but that I was really inside of a community that was pushing me to transition quickly. And I know from personal experience that when you do transition, that has a high risk of bringing sexual dysfunction with it. And I can't, even if you had good predictors of somebody who is likely to transition, I would still say that adolescents should not be having permanent medicalization until they've had a chance to really live in their bodies for a little while to see if they can learn to accept them and have comfort with them. Because I didn't have that. And if there's one thing that I would be able to change for younger people who are gender nonconforming or trans identified or however you want to call it, it would be to encourage them that they can, that there's a possibility that they could learn to become comfortable with their bodies without having to change them.
That is powerful and wise advice that I don't think I can better. The one additional thing that I would insist on as being desirable is that autogynephilic persons considering transition should know about autogynephilia. If their desire to transition is based on this idea, which is false, that they are just like women, but they have the wrong body, I think that isn't going to make for the best decision. And I have corresponded with people who have, on learning about autogynephilia, decided not to transition. By the way, I've also corresponded with some who went ahead. Like Anne Lawrence knew, she knew about autogynephilia before she went ahead. It's not that if you accept yourself as autogynephilic that, oh, well, that just takes all the wind out of your sail. But I think it helps people make better decisions. Hmm. Autogynephilia also, there is no evidence that it ever goes away. I mean, it's a sexual orientation more or less, but it's just as persistent as homosexuality or heterosexuality. And it's some unusual form of heterosexuality. It's not going to go away. And there is this interesting phenomenon, at least there used to be back in the old days, by which I mean before 2010, of late transitioning married heterosexual men. So it is something that is such a powerful influence on them that they utterly change their lives, you know, in ways that makes their lives more difficult in many ways. Male sexuality is a powerful motivator. That's one difference between men and women that I'll stick by. I think women are less motivated by their sexuality, which protects them from making many stupid mistakes that males make.
We make a lot of they make other mistakes.
Yeah.
And when I was young, I was crazy. You know, I had a very high sex drive, but it certainly did not stay that high throughout my life. I have another important question. What are some ways you've seen men successfully manage their autogynephilia without transitioning?
Well, I'm not sure. I definitely know such men. The most extreme case, this was somebody who, again, I know because he contacted me as my book. He was real close to transition, and he was, you know, he's an heir to a family business that makes good living, and he was going to lose his wife or partner, I forget which. He went on Lupron, which is, among its many effects, it's sex drive reducing. Sex drive pretty much eliminating. It effectively gets rid of all the effects of testosterone on your body. And it is sometimes used to I don't know if treats the word, to manage sex offenders. It's also used for the treatment of prostate cancer. Anyway, it worked, totally worked for him. And he was very happy to have done that. And he was still able to have sex with his wife, he says, using Viagra or something like that. Another guy I know, he was a prospective graduate student who wanted to work with me. And he was married, and he read my book, and his wife read my book, and she was terrified. And he just was committed that because of her, he wouldn't. So now, is that managing? Maybe he just had a less intense case of autogynephilia. I don't know. This is another one of those things that needs to be studied, but it hasn't. The people who attacked me in 2003 and 4 and 5 and 6 and less so going on, but they, you know, they hurt me, obviously, but they did immense damage to persons with autogynephilia by preventing people from doing useful research on these kinds of questions. And I hope people will realize that about them. They are not admirable. They should be ashamed for the damage they've done. Not to me, but to autogynephilic persons.
I don't know if you would describe the trans community as a cult. I don't want to put you in a position of having to answer that if you don't want to. I think it is. And one of the things that I see a lot of is that there's this, it's a meme, really, because people who don't have even the first idea of what AGP entails will say, right, AGP is a myth. It's been debunked. It's pseudoscience. It's not proven, which is interesting, because the social sciences,
right,
prove things a little bit differently than the hard sciences do. It's an explanation, right? It's not a hard science theory, but it's a model to explain the etiology of trans identification, right? So it can't be mathematically proven in the same way that astronomical bodies in motion are modeled, right? There's just so much rejection and denial of the model itself.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of effort to reject the data, because most of the data are just people telling you how they feel. a natal male says, I'm really sexually aroused by the idea of being a woman. On what basis does one reject that claim? And then there are these alternatives that some people say, well, you know, that's, women are like that. They are, now we're about to publish a big paper falsifying that claim. Women look very different on these scales than autogynephilic males. I just want to, in case I haven't already said this, I think I did once, but I don't think one can say it too much. I really strongly admire honest and open autogynephilic persons, almost all of whom that I've corresponded with or known are kind people too. Autogynephilia, and believe me, I've known the unkind version who are also not open and honest. I think there's something there, and maybe it's just a certain kind of person just can't accept certain kinds of self-knowledge.
I'm feeling a little bit optimistic about some younger men who are desisting or detransitioning, who know that they're autogynephilic and are talking to other young men who are autogynephilic. That seems like a really good development.
Yeah, I think I've listened to podcasts featuring some of these people, and I believe the most usual story, maybe not in all cases, is that they didn't know about organophilia really until, and once they did, that helped spoil the fun. I think on Megan Dom's podcast, of all places, like a week or two ago, there was an autogynephilic detransitioner who may have known about autogynephilia. He denied being part of a trans cult anyway. There's certainly something cult-like about trans all the people that we have going on. And I'm another research initiative that I'll just mention in collaboration with Ken Zucker, whose idea it was, and Lisa Littman. We are launching a long-term follow-up study of adolescents with gender dysphoria. It'll be predominantly natal females. And we're going to do similar things to what Kevin is doing with mostly natal males.
I hope that you investigate the role of pornography.
You said that on one of the podcasts that I listened to, and so we can maybe disagree a little here. I believe that for atypical sexualities, pornography is more of a sign, a vehicle, perhaps a way of learning about oneself than it is a cause. One would have to do an experiment that one can never do to know for sure. I actually have never watched it, so I don't know exactly what sissy porn entails, but I can probably intuit. Somebody who becomes autogynephilic after seeing sissy porn, I think, was likely already autogynephilic and didn't know about it.
So you think it's innate and not something that develops through
good. Thanks for asking that. That's another thing that I think maybe listening to that podcast, I was knowing that I disagreed with you about. Yes, I absolutely think autogynephilia and all male sexualities are innate, but can I prove it? No. I mean, so I can prove, here's the best example, and it doesn't have to do with autogynephilia, it has to do with just typical heterosexuality. There have been certain medical conditions or surgical traumas resulting in a hormonally normal male child being reassigned and reared as a female very early in life. So one of them is cloacal extrophy. It doesn't matter, I guess. But there are also some surgical accidents in which the boy's penis was burned off. Follow these children up into adolescence and in some cases adulthood. They are all, without exception, sexually attracted to women and not to men, despite having been reared as females. And I think if you can't change a male's sexuality by cutting off his penis and rearing him as a girl, how likely are these conditioning or socialization explanations of male sexuality? And I don't find any of them compelling. Now, that said, you can't have furries without cartoon animals, you know, and various other paraphilias also require them.
You're saying nobody is born wanting to become a cartoon animal?
No, okay. I don't think so. But I think they're born different.
Yeah.
And so there is a case I know about of a practitioner of autoerotic asphyxia, which is a very extreme, very dangerous form of masochism, who learned that a classmate committed suicide by hanging and immediately was practicing autoerotic asphyxia. Got the idea from that.
So it's rapid onset autoerotic asphyxiation. Yeah,
well, yes, okay. but not socially contagious in the same way.
Oh, okay.
It requires, what kind of person has that reaction? That is, there was some kind of fertile soil in that person. And I think that that's the way paraphilias probably work.
We agree then. I do think that there's a kind of fertile soil. I guess you heard me say this. I do think that men are really vulnerable in puberty and just before puberty, and that exposure to porn at that age can have a much bigger effect than it would if it were somebody who was exploring porn in their 20s or 30s because they already had a paraphilia. And I also think that the overwhelming, okay, like you, not that I use porn, particularly modern porn. I had to see some porn when I was being trained for San Francisco sex information, but that was a long time ago. And I'm not male, but it sure seems like if you are watching people having sex and all of the target is a woman, always a woman, you know, the thing that the sex is directed at is the woman. It would make sense to me that that's how you would think, okay, sex directed at something is a woman, right? Like the desired, the object of it is a woman. That's just what it is. I don't really imagine porn is showing nuanced or complex relationships.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could, just based on that, it would make sense to me that if a lot of young heterosexual boys, young men are seeing this, that it would program in. It's like, oh yeah, if I want. And I do think about my experience with my autogynephilic ex, who really, really wanted to be that kind of object. Although he was my age, so he was not exposed to internet porn as a child. But still, he understood our cultural ideas of who's supposed to be desirable. And he really wanted that. You know, I think he had a kind of loneliness in a way, and it's a dissatisfaction with a lot of things.
So I'm 64, and since I was an adolescent, had occasional exposure to whatever pornography existed, though I guess maybe not movies, but certainly Penthouse, Playboy, if you've heard of those were magazines with pictures, which, can you imagine people getting aroused by mere pictures? But that's what we had. I don't think there's a big difference between the kind of arousal, masturbatory behavior by adolescent boys back in my cohort and finding more typical porn, you know, man and a woman, man and two women or whatever, you know, having various kinds of sex in videos. There is weird stuff that you can easily find now that, you know, one couldn't find before. But my strong hunch is that if people's sexuality appears to change after seeing some kind of weird porn, it was latent and that was a trigger. You know, that allowed them to discover that. That's my hunch, which I can't prove. But, you know, Nina, you had asked before about strategies for managing autogynephilia. I would put forward as a hypothesis, not as something I'm sure about, but that avoiding certain kinds of pornography might be a way of managing, you know, reducing the autogynephilic sex drive or the stimulation might be a way of managing it. Again, I don't know, but it seems plausible to me.
I think that's actually helpful to a lot of men. Like, use less porn.
Yeah. Well, and I do think that porn can, so I can imagine that porn could be detrimental to relationship, though there's a chicken and egg issue. And I think in many relationships early on, it's hot and heavy. And there's probably, I would guess, the man is not using as much porn as he might use 5 years into a relationship after the Coolidge effect has set in. Is, to what extent is the porn causing it? In the community of sex researchers that I inhabit, who talk to me and who I talk to because they're worth talking to, the most common beliefs about porn, and is that its harmfulness has been exaggerated, and they provide data for it. But again, nobody does a randomized controlled study because you can't. But I'm sympathetic to the possibility that porn is sometimes harmful.
Dr. Bailey, thank you so much for spending your time with us. I'm sure we're going to have you back if we can. And I want to know for anybody in the audience, what should they go check out? Do you have any recent books or movies or materials that they should check out to know more about your research?
They could go to my Google Scholar or ResearchGate page. I don't haven't written another book, but I'm going to provide you a link if you have the ability to link to a free copy of my book, which everybody should download and read and share.
With their whole families.
With their whole families.
Yes. Right? Free culture. We can have a whole other conversation about that. I am thrilled that you have discovered the wonder of free culture with that book. Anyway, TERFs and trannies, thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support our podcast by visiting anchor.fm/heterodorks or by directly supporting Nina Paley on Patreon at patreon.com/Nina Paley.